The next case is Ward versus El Rancho, and I think I see one lawyer, but not the other lawyer. So the next matter is Dustin Ward et al. Versus El Rancho Manana et al. It's A19-1592. And you each will have 15 minutes for your argument. The podium goes up and down if you want to adjust it to make it comfortable for yourself. And when you begin your argument, please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sarah Jewell, J-E-W-E-L-L, on behalf of appellants. May it please the court. This case is rather unique, and in my time in Stearns County, practicing primarily in the St. Cloud, Minnesota area, I have actually never seen a case be bumped to three different district court judges, as has occurred in this case. And I guess the reason that that stands out so...
Apparently you were never in Hennepin County.
Yeah, I guess maybe that speaks to my time and experience. I'm not sure. But at any rate, I guess why that stands out to me and why I feel that's important to sort of lead with in today's argument is that procedural unfairness really seems pretty evident to me in this matter. And I think part of that arises out of the fact that this family business has been in operation since the 60s. Which is the El Rancho Manana campground. I myself have been out there many times horseback riding in the hills. It's beautiful. And, you know, unfortunately, this has devolved into a pretty big family battle, and there are different factions, as you can tell. And why I feel that relates to the procedural unfairness is that I'm certain that, you know, many people, St. Cloud is a large town, but still a small town. And a lot of people know each other, and especially when they're involved in businesses. As you can tell, Judge Mahler initially was assigned to the case. We had held an initial scheduling conference. The parties did not agree as to dates. The respondents in this case brought an early dispositive motion based on a prior case that wasn't even done, was still pending at the time. And, you know, I tried to work things out with opposing counsel. I was very agreeable to sort of going in a different direction at that time, but I was relying solely on Judge Mahler's promise and her order, in fact, that we would follow up after 60 days to complete the Rule 16 scheduling order and discuss any further issues that may have arisen after sort of this informal discovery process. And that never happened. And I really feel that that's important to this case because my clients, as the I guess the third generation, the grandchildren essentially of the original owners, really do have the right, in my view and in our position, to have these rights looked at by a court under a Chapter 555 declaratory judgment action, separate and apart from sort of these other family disputes related to the shareholder action.
When I looked at your petition for declaratory judgment, and I looked at, so count one is the rule against perpetuities, right? And then count two, you asked to declare the lease more or less invalid as an equitable mortgage. And I was looking through it, and I sat on the appeals panel for the prior case,
okay.
So I'm familiar with that.
Sure.
And one of the things that got sent back was that the appellants in that case said that they personally were suffering some injury by not being able to go on the land, and apparently there's been a trial on their individual claims. But right. the majority of the claims were found to be derivative. And when I looked at count two in your petition, I didn't see anything that was personal to your clients. It all appears to be derivative as I read the petition. Would you agree with my characterization of that?
Thank you, Your Honor. I do. I wholeheartedly do. And as the case did proceed after we went from Judge Mahler to Judge Wong, then finally to Judge Scherer, where we started having to respond to the early dispositive motion, it became clear that we needed to add some additional claims because that was part of what my clients were complaining to me about, is that they feel ousted from using the land, even with respect to those subparts of the lease that ostensibly allow them to freely use the land so long as they're not interfering with the campground operations. And even to that point, it's my understanding now that on March 25th, so later this month, the majority shareholders in WFI or Ward Family Inc. Have called a special meeting to determine whether the minority shareholders, which do include my three clients, can do things such as, you know, putting honeybee boxes. You know, we have a shortage of honeybees. And, you know, that's something that they're interested in doing out on the property with their dad. So now, instead of just them going out and doing that in a remote area away from the campground, WFI majority shareholders have deemed that they need to have a special meeting to discuss whether that can occur and where that might be able to occur and et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, that is not part of the lease. It is not a term included in the lease. That would require or even suggest that a special meeting, corporate meeting with a vote, I'm sure, would have to take place in order for them to exercise that portion of the lease. And so, Judge Riley, to your point, Justice Riley, pardon me, with all due respect, I agree completely with you, and that's, again, sort of ties back to my procedural unfairness in this case.
Well, let me ask you about this then, mm-hmm. because your briefing and I believe the petition focused on paragraphs 3 and 9 of the lease.
Yes.
But it's 8 that deals with use.
Okay, that's right. And that's exactly what we were getting to, and we did actually file a motion to amend the pleadings as the case went forward in this really shortened time manner when it became apparent that those were also complaints that needed to be brought in the same action. And again, due to the lack of a Rule 16 scheduling order, I don't mean to sort of beat that proverbial dead horse too much, but we needed to have some orderly fashion where sort of non-dispositive motions would be heard and settled and determined before dispositive motions would be heard. And in fact, we had an overlap there, as I'm sure you saw in our briefing, to where we had paid the motion filing fee and submitted our brief and obtained a hearing date from the court, and then only found out some 8 or 9 days later that the dispositive motion had been ruled on but had not been served and filed upon the parties. And so that's exactly the reason why we needed to have that Rule 16 scheduling order in place.
I guess, and I understand the argument you're making, and I certainly agree with you, it's always best to have one judge from start to finish. Right. But, you know, dealing with the prejudice you suffered in not getting more discovery before summary judgment. I mean, let me ask you this. Are you required, if you're going to do that, to specify in an affidavit the specific evidence you expect to get, the source of discovery necessary to obtain that evidence, and the reasons for the failure to complete discovery? Now, was that, was any of that information proffered in your affidavits in which you asked for more discovery?
Going back to that time frame, I think that we were able to allege in, it was actually declarations, I believe, that my clients supplied to the court related to those claims of direct harm. And, you know, we could have gotten, as Judge Mahler had, you know, was going to allow us to do limited additional testimony in terms of depositions. You know, if we needed to go back and get someone's testimony for 20 minutes on the record in order to use that in a dispositive motion, she was intending to allow us to do that. So I guess, you know, I'm not certain that we articulated that specifically, but it had already been on the record and was the understanding of counsel and the court, you know, the district court judge assigned at the time, you know, that perhaps not the full breadth of discovery would be permitted, but a limited narrow scope that would pertain to these claims and these parties. And that's the other point too. My three clients were not, you know, their voice wasn't heard very, very much on this, honestly, because it was just in the matter of declarations that were submitted discussing how they feel they've been ousted from the land and unable to use it when they have tried, that they've sort of gotten the shakedown from a Rancho Manana staff and or, you know, the family member who's running that business, questioning them, you know, what are you doing, yelling, you know, it's unfortunately, it's this family dispute. And so we were able to get that out on the record, and that was part of the court record at the time. Well, Your Honors, I see I've got 5 minutes. Oh, I'm so sorry. I've got 5 minutes and 30 seconds. I realize I did not reserve rebuttal initially, but I would like to.
5 minutes. For rebuttal.
Okay, perfect.
You have 15 minutes.
Thank you.
I'm listening to your argument, mm-hmm. and you're bringing up now this possible plan by your clients to have bees on the premises and everything, but none of this was argued before the district court, right? And
not with respect to the bees.
It certainly wasn't raised in your briefing. I mean, as I understand it, the complaint is mainly with regard to paragraph 3 of the lease and maybe a couple others, not paragraph 8. Am I correct?
Well,
because that's what's before us right now.
Right. I mean, it's, again, the procedural unfairness, I think, really shadows everything that was done in the case. But as to your point on the lease paragraphs, yes, we were looking primarily for a declaratory action from the district court to clarify the rights of my clients under paragraph 3 of the lease with respect to the terms. You know, this is as you're probably very well aware, this is something that could feasibly go on forever. We've got two 20-year terms back to back and then yearly terms thereafter at the sole discretion of the lessee, which is the El Rancho Manana business, which is owned by my client's uncle.
Why aren't your clients barred from basically what looks like a relitigation of the prior minority shareholder lawsuit that's already been before this court and those issues have been resolved?
Right. I appreciate the opportunity to address that. So in our brief, we did discuss that. Minnesota courts have held that even in certain cases where prior litigation has taken place may involve some of the same parties. In this case, it actually does not involve the exact same parties in interest. My clients were not privy to those actions. They were not part of the attorney-client privilege meetings that took place. They weren't able to
articulate. They were shareholders of the same corporation, right?
They were as of 2000.
It's a derivative claim. It's a claim of the corporation.
Correct.
So why wouldn't privity, why isn't there privity then? I understand it's different shareholders, but, mm-hmm. you know, if it's the corporation's claims, why doesn't that trump the argument you're making now?
Thank you. That's an excellent question, and I would like to address that. So these are different claims. They're not the same claims. My clients have directly.
It could have been brought in the prior lawsuit, which were also derivative claims of the corporation, right?
Some of them possibly.
Let's say these weren't derivative claims. They were just, you know, in lawsuit A, corporation sues the other corporation for one of those claims, and, you know, that corporation A loses. Mm-hmm. Well, in the second lawsuit, if corporation A could have brought those claims, wouldn't we normally say, you know, out to lunch, res judicata, same corporation, you could have brought those claims, you didn't, you lose. So what I'm trying to find is, why doesn't that same analysis apply, Ms. Jewell?
Thank you, Your Honor. So the reason why it doesn't apply to this case is that in order to have these claims barred, as you're describing, they would have to meet all of the elements of res judicata and or claim preclusion. And at the time that was brought in the underlying case here today, Those claims were not fully adjudicated, and I wasn't a party to that case. I did not represent any of the parties in that, so I am, you know, definitely at a disadvantage to have a full understanding of that. I'm not privileged to all those, you know, pleadings and things, but it's my understanding that that was a bifurcated case. Some of the claims were adjudicated at some point. I know some of them, as Judge Hooten pointed out, are still on appeal and pending. So those are not final claims, and so that would defeat some of the prongs that they would have to meet. The other things I mentioned earlier, again, that's the different parties, and I understand the connection because it is a family business, and so I'm sure that they had heard of some of those things through so-called the grapevine, but they also are saying to the court, we feel that our individual rights as being able to use the land. And if I did put in paragraph, you know, 9 instead of 8, it's likely a typo because we are talking about their use, you know, recreationally to use a business on the property, to use basically the other 1,000 acres that are out there, except for the 200 that encompass the campground itself.
Is there, I mean, is this a ripe claim? I mean, has anyone said no to your clients?
Yes, they have.
And where in the brief has all of this been raised, that they have in fact been injured because they can't use? I mean, you're telling us now for the first time that they want this bee operation.
Right, and that is new, I guess.
Before the court.
The underlying claims that were there before the court, and I appreciate the opportunity to address that, is that in their declarations they did describe times, each of my three clients provided declarations to the district court that described times when they did go out to the property and that they felt they were getting sort of the shakedown by Mr. Kevin Ward, who is the owner of El Rancho Manana, who is the lessee of their corporation, WFI. And that describes in detail sort of those incidents that did occur. So there's a fact dispute there, and that's part of our summary judgment response, which was to the district court. I see my time is out. Thank you.
5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
I don't think I've ever had to move this up. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Chris Wills. I represent the respondents in this matter. The respondents respectfully request that this court affirm the district court in all respects. I have two general topics that I intend to discuss today. The first topic was going to be that the district court correctly concluded that the claims in count 2 of the petition were derivative, but I believe my co-counsel has just now admitted that that decision was correct. So I'll limit that portion of my discussion to the argument that the district court correctly concluded that those derivative claims were barred by res judicata. The second topic that I'd like to talk about are these procedural issues and the district court's decision to move forward with the summary judgment hearing in June of 2019. I don't intend to get into the rule of perpetuities issue. I know it's been raised in the briefs. If there are any questions about that, of course, I'm happy to answer any of those questions. I'm going to start with topic number 2, which is where Ms. Jewell started today, and I want to go through in some level of detail how exactly it is that we get to this summary judgment hearing in June of 2019, because it's laid out in the briefs, but even I'm now a little confused as to how we got there. So we have the case brought in December of 2019. The initial petition, as this court has pointed out, I believe it was you, Judge Hooten, pointed out, contains a claim for a violation of the rule against perpetuities and then contains derivative claims. There is no claim in there at all that the appellant's direct rights to access the property have at any time been violated. In fact, at the summary judgment hearing, Ms. Jewell was asked, are those claims before the court? And her response was, no, they're not. That's at page 6 of the summary judgment transcript, which is document number 82 in the index. So that claim is not brought. Now, after the district court enters its order, there is a motion that is filed by the appellants in this case. It's after the order is entered, but before the order is sent out to the parties. And the specific purpose of that motion was to add these direct claims. But at the time the summary judgment motion was brought and decided by Judge Scheer, these claims, these direct claims, were not before the court. Now, we move forward, and in March of 2019, we file our dispositive motion. By the March 8, 2019 scheduling hearing, that dispositive motion and the memorandum in support of it had been on file for approximately 1 week. We get to the hearing, and the parties develop this system for how we're going to deal with this early dispositive motion. And the plan that's agreed to by everyone at that hearing is that the motion is going to be set off for a June 24, 2019 hearing. Documents are going to be made available to the appellants. There's a telephone status conference that's set in May. And the whole purpose of that status conference is appellant's counsel is supposed to have reviewed all the documents that have been made available to her, and she's supposed to be able to articulate with specificity exactly what it is that she wants moving forward in terms of discovery so that she can respond to these dispositive motions. Appellant's counsel is told these documents are available for you to come over and review. She doesn't do that. They're eventually sent to her by Dropbox, and when she finally gets them by Dropbox, unfortunately, at that point, we've had a change in the judge, and the telephone status conferences, for reasons that remain unclear, canceled. It doesn't happen. There's actually a letter that I sent in to Judge Scheer after he was reassigned, asking him to keep that telephone status conference on, but it doesn't end up happening. So we get to the due date for the appellant's response brief to the summary judgment motion. Now, at this point, Judge Conley, as you pointed out, the appellants have the opportunity to file an affidavit that complies with Rule 56.04 and request a continuance from the summary judgment hearing. They don't do that. They file declarations. The declarations do not comply with Rule 56.04. And the noncompliance is important here because they don't just, you know, not meet the affidavit requirement, which I suppose is technical and could be waived, but those affidavits don't say what exactly it is that the appellants are seeking through their discovery. They say things like, we want expert witness depositions. Those aren't allowed under the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure, but they say that's what we want, but they don't say, here's what this discovery is going to uncover, and they don't say, here's how that discovery is going to allow us to forestall summary judgment on these claims. None of that is in there. In fact, today, March 11th, 2020, we still don't know what exactly it is that the discovery was going to accomplish as to those derivative claims that had been asserted in the petition. So the district court goes through with the hearing. We have, we obviously have the result, and now we go up on appeal. And when we come up on appeal, in the opening brief that the appellants provide, they identify in the statement of legal issues. They say one of our complaints is that there was no Rule 16 scheduling order put in place. We didn't have the opportunity to conduct discovery. But when you go to the legal argument section of their brief, there is no argument about that issue. None. It's nowhere. In the conclusion section, there's a passing comment that, you know, they should have been allowed the opportunity to conduct discovery. But there is no explanation. So when the respondents are preparing their response brief, they don't know what the argument is. So we put in the response brief two things. Number one, that they failed to raise this issue in the argument section, so they've waived the argument. We cite some case law to that effect. And then number two, that even if they haven't waived the argument, here's how you properly request a continuance from the summary judgment rule or from a summary judgment hearing, and they didn't do that. Now, in the reply brief, and again today, the appellants stand up and say, well, you know, look, we were denied procedural due process. We got these three different judges, and, you know, respondents' counsel apparently had a better handle on the facts of this case than I did, and that was procedurally unfair to our clients. That is nowhere in the opening brief. It is extremely prejudicial for them to make that argument in their reply brief without first making it in their opening brief. This court's case law holds very clearly that they're required to make that argument in their opening brief so that I have the opportunity to address it in my response brief. Procedural due process appears absolutely nowhere in their opening brief. So if this court is inclined to consider those arguments, I'd ask that you provide me with an opportunity to submit a surreply brief or a supplemental brief that's specifically keyed to those issues. Otherwise, this court should simply hold that the appellants have waived their arguments as to those issues. Our brief further lays out how they failed to properly request a continuance, so I'm not going to go into any more detail on that. Now, on the count two claims, Ms. Jewell has now admitted those claims were derivative in nature as they were asserted in the complaint, so I don't need to go through any detail on that. But that leaves the issue of, were those claims barred by res judicata? Now, there are four factors for res judicata. Number one, the prior proceeding must involve the same set of circumstances as the subsequent proceeding. Number two, the prior proceeding must involve the same parties or their privies. Number three, the prior proceeding must have come to a final judgment on the merits. Now, again, in their brief, the appellants say this third factor is undisputed. It came to a final judgment on the merits. Today, during argument, I guess Ms. Jewell is now arguing that that's not the case and that she's not sure that the prior case came to a final judgment on the merits. There's case law from this court and from the Minnesota Supreme Court that says a final judgment is when judgment is entered by the district court. That's happened here. It doesn't matter that the first case is up on appeal. It's still a final judgment on the merits. Again, if the court would like additional information on this, I'm happy to provide a supplemental brief with a citation. The fourth factor is that the estopped party must have a full and fair opportunity to litigate the matter in the prior proceeding. Now, the most important part about res judicata is that it's an equitable doctrine and it's a flexible doctrine. In terms of the first factor, the focus of that first factor is on the factual circumstances of the two lawsuits. So if we look at the first lawsuit, we have claims by Charlie, Katie, and Tom, the plaintiffs in the case. They're also shareholders in WFI. And those claims are that the rent provisions and the improvement provisions should be declared invalid in a 2012 lease between WFI and ERM. In this case, we have claims by shareholders of WFI, Dustin, Kayla, and Kelsey, that the rent provisions and the improvement provisions in a 2012 lease between WFI and ERM should be invalidated. The factual circumstances are exactly the same. The legal theories under which they're couched may be different, but our focus here is factual circumstances, and those are identical.
I was going to ask you about privity, because you're asking us to hold that the different shareholders from a corporation bringing a later derivative claim share privity with the original shareholders who brought the first lawsuit. Do you know of any Minnesota cases that support that statement?
There are no Minnesota cases that have held that, Your Honor. Now, what we do have is we have cases from other jurisdictions. The leading case on it was cited in our brief. It's a Delaware Supreme Court case from 2013 called Pioit versus Louisiana Municipal Police Employees Retirement System. That case, I say it's the leading case. I don't know whether that's actually accurate. It's just the case that collects all the cases from around the nation and says, here's what these cases are doing in those circumstances. And that case says that when you have the exact same circumstances we have here, you have a corporate decision like the lease, you have two sets of shareholders who are upset about that decision and who start two separate lawsuits. One goes to a final judgment on the merits before the other. What happens to the second lawsuit? That's the exact circumstance that we have here. The court in Pioit, I apologize to Mr. Pioit, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. They have, with near unanimity, concluded that the two lawsuits involve the same parties because, number one, the derivative claim belongs to and is brought on behalf of the corporation, and number two, the corporation is ultimately the real party in interest. That reasoning is entirely consistent with Minnesota law. In the In Re United Health Group Inc. shareholder derivative litigation, which was a Supreme Court case from 2008, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that a derivative claim belongs to the corporation, and although it can be brought on behalf of a shareholder, it ultimately remains a corporate claim, and the real party in interest is the corporation.
Do you think it matters that PO dealt with collateral estoppel and not res judicata?
I do not, Your Honor, because collateral estoppel and res judicata are extremely similar doctrines. The only difference would be that collateral estoppel is, hey, we decided this one issue back in this prior litigation. Res judicata is broader. It's denying the entire claim. Now, we made the argument that any arguments that the lease wasn't in the best interest of the corporation is also barred by collateral estoppel. But since that's the only claim that has been brought on the, because, you know, the count one claim, you can just dismiss that. Since that's the only claim that's been brought in count two, it's res judicata. If these, I agree, if the direct claims had been asserted in the complaint, the argument would be collateral estoppel as to the derivative claims. And since that's the only difference between the two, and collateral estoppel and res judicata, both, what you need for both of those is the same parties or their privities, that's what POIT focuses on. So I don't think that's a distinguishing factor for POIT, Your Honor.
We only have 2 minutes, and I want to deal with this issue that was raised in the direct argument here by the appellant. And that is as to, I think, and I'm going to paraphrase, I hope I do it right. She's saying, I just want a declaratory judgment so that my clients will know what they can and can't do vis-a-vis this property, and that's a direct claim, and therefore the court erred by not allowing me to pursue that claim. How do you respond to that? And they've come up today for the first time we hear about this bee business they want to do.
I think you've adequately summarized the issue with the bees. So, Your Honor, in terms of the Declaratory Judgment Act, I think you have to look at the petition for your answer to that question. The petition was much more specific than just asking for a declaration of here's what our rights are under the lease. I agree. If the claim would have been in the petition, we want a declaration of what we can and cannot do on this property because of this issue related to the bees, and we just don't know. Kevin's telling us we can't do this. The lease seems to indicate that we can. That would be the appropriate matter for a Declaratory Judgment Act. That's not what was alleged in the petition. What the petition specifically alleges is that the court should declare the rent provision in the lease invalid and establish a market-based rent for this property and for ERM, and that the court should also declare the improvement provision invalid because it constitutes an equitable mortgage. Both of those claims, as Ms. Jules admitted today, are derivative. They're not asking for an interpretation of what are our rights under the lease. They're asking that the court invalidate these provisions. As to the rule against perpetuities, which is the count one claim, I think the primary problem that you run into that is you have to establish that there's the potential that the lease could violate the rule against perpetuities, and it's absolutely clear that under no set of circumstances could the lease ever violate the rule against perpetuities because any contingent interest will vest within 90 years of when the lease was created. My time is up. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Jewell, any rebuttal?
Keep this very limited to just a few points. I believe that Mr. Wells is somewhat mischaracterizing the appellant's position with respect to our claims. What I had stated is that we believe that respondents did not meet all the elements of res judicata, and that's explained in our brief. I won't go through all of that. Initially, we did not have all of the claims added, but that again goes to my procedural unfairness, and I completely disagree with Mr. Will's assertion that he was not aware that we were bringing those type of claims. That was actually argued before Judge Scherer mentioned regarding the direct claims at the summary judgment hearing as well. And so he was very well aware of that. I think there's no shock or surprise to him or his clients at all that.
But do you agree that they are not put in your...
They were not petition. In the leading petition, no, because, again, you know, as the case proceeded, which is, you know, that happens, you become aware of additional facts and circumstances that need to be addressed, you know, while litigation proceeds forward, and we were trying to address that. The other thing that I'd like to point out is that respondents can't blame the appellants with respect to the timing on that motion to amend, again, because the procedures were just not in place. We, of course, were not aware that the court had entered its decision and order on the dispositive motion on July 31st until August 8th or 9th. I'm forgetting the date, but it was certainly at least a week's worth of time in between. And, you know, furthermore, if the court had already entered that order, I doubt that court administration would allow us to have a hearing date set in order to have that claim heard. And you know, it just shows that this was rushed through because, again, so many of the district court judges within Stearns County are very cognizant and aware of the situation. Makes it very difficult for us to proceed.
Well, could I mean, in this case, your motion to amend came in, wasn't it like 10, 20 days after the motion for summary judgment?
Correct. It was, I think we had that hearing June 24th, and I think the next week was 4th of July or something around that, and it came in after that, correct?
And isn't the denial or the granting of a motion to amend a discretionary call by the judge?
Certainly it is, and I guess the part that I'm more complaining about is that we didn't get that opportunity during a non-dispositive. Typically, there'd be a non-dispositive motion deadline, and we'd have those claims sort of whittled down or added or subtracted at that point before we move on to a dispositive motion.
I mean, but the judge here basically said, enough, you know, this has been litigated for a decade. I think it looks like a fishing expedition going on here with your discovery. And the judge then denied the motion to amend because based on timing. I mean, isn't that within the realm of the judge's discretion to deny it just on that basis alone?
I think that definitely a scheduling of a case is within the judge's discretion, and I feel that discretion was abused in this case because we were not allowed to proceed in the typical fashion of a case to have those legal arguments made in a way that makes sense, in a way that's organized, in a way that assists the parties in being able to address, you know, the other side of the issue. I just want to get back to a couple of other points. Mr. Wills makes some very highly technical arguments regarding the due process and regarding his, you know, claim of surprise in knowing that we felt we were, you know, with three different judges and then again not having the follow-up that Judge Mahler had promised us. That's what we agreed to. We didn't agree to let the case just run amok. I would not be doing my job very well if I had agreed to that and just willy-nilly go forward. And so, you know, it really goes back to that original agreement between Judge Mahler, myself, and Mr. Wills in court. The only thing that I feel today we did describe or discuss regarding my clients, and it's in the brief and at summary judgment as well, is that we agreed that my clients were not direct owners of the land that is held by WFI in their names individually. They are owners by way of their membership in WFI, which is the Ward Family Incorporated. But again, you know, this is not Monsanto. This is not 3M. This is a different type of situation when you have a family, you know, closely held corporation. So I know that that was one of the arguments that Judge Scherer had made, or not arguments, I should say, a clarifying question he was asking at the dispositive motion hearing, you know, well, isn't this like Monsanto? Really, it's not. I mean, these people were promised that this was their family legacy, that they were going to be able to use the land just as they had always done as kids growing up, and it has just not become that way. The other thing I want to mention about the bees, I almost wish I hadn't brought that up now because I don't want this court to think this is a Thiel v. Stitch case, you know, where I'm bringing up new information at the first time on appeal. That is not the case. The only reason I brought that up is to explain how we do need clarification on the rights under the lease with respect to my three clients, because now that we're trying to do things, you know, more with the land and in addition to the examples that were already presented at the district court level, there's just roadblocks after roadblocks being put forward. And again, if the court would be allowed to make a declaratory judgment on those rights, it would resolve those claims for these people. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. Our next case is an ITV case, and we're going to take a little break while that gets set up. So thank you, and safe travels back to the St. Cloud area.
How was the drive this morning?